With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0.
Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
And welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. It's a pleasure to be here with you folks. We're going to get right into it. I have a fantastic guest. Her name is Keisha King. She is the former regional engagement coordinator for Black Voices for Trump. She's also the founder of King Consulting and holds a bachelor's degree in business marketing. Now, your eyes do not deceive you. She does look Black, although we know since she's a Trump supporter, she can't possibly be Black. She's the former director of communications for the Jacksonville Young Republicans. That's no surprise. She's a four-time singer of the national anthem for President Trump's rallies. We're going to ask her to sing in a little bit. She's also the co-chair of Moms for Liberty in Nebraska. No, sorry. Where? Where is that? Moms for Liberty.
Northeast Florida.
Oh, Northeast Florida. I'm like, that's not Nebraska. That's not possible. She's an advocate for Christian conservative values. Keisha King, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. So great to be here.
So I've talked previously about Moms for Liberty, which is a relatively new organization. You guys are just blowing up.
Yes.
So tell me about, let's start there, your involvement with Moms for America. I have a feeling it's going to lead to the discussion on critical race theory.
Yes. So I got involved with Moms for Liberty. They came to one of our Republican meetings and they were just talking about the struggles that they had had with the school board and what made them start the group. Tina Deskovich had come to Jacksonville, Florida. And just listening to her, it was so inspiring. And parents and moms and women who were there, they were asking questions like, you know, hey, what can we do? And so me and my big mouth, I got up and I was like, we have to stand up for our children and fight back. And so after, Tina's like, you should be a co-chair. And I was like, no, I was just trying to, you know, help get the women motivated and kind of steer them in the right direction. But after speaking with her and some other ladies, I decided to co-chair with another a wonderful young woman. And it's just, I mean, it's been growing. We're still, you know, it's our chapter is new. So we're trying to, you know, make sure our infrastructure is right and get all those things worked out. But we have so many parents that want to be involved and that can't wait to jump in there. And actually, we're already doing it, you know, going to school board meetings as a unit to show our strength and support for our children.
Right. So what is it in your own words? How are you thinking that you're going to change the CRT that's happening in the schools?
I think what we have to do, we're certainly grateful for the banning of it in the official realm by Governor DeSantis. But I think in addition to that, we still have to remain vigilant and show up to these school board meetings and present our case and really keep an eye on what they are trying to introduce to our children. I think that is the only way they will take us seriously. I think it's the only way that we will actually create change and get the school board members who are refusing to stop this nonsense, get them out of those seats and put people there who will stand up for the teachers' unions and who will not enforce this type of ideology on our children.
You said stand up to the teachers' unions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really coming from the teachers' unions. And I have to ask, so the thing is that with CRT, with critical race theory, you're dealing with ideologues. I don't know if you saw, there was an article a little while ago, I think it was teachers out of Ohio, who had said, hey, you might tell me not to teach this in the schools, but I know what I know, and I'm going to teach what I want to teach. And
right.
So it's not, and I love the fact that you're saying, hey, it's great that DeSantis, you know, banned it in its official capacity. You will not be teaching this and you will be teaching that. But the problem that I see is if the teachers are ideologues, and many of them at this point are because they went through the training, you know, their training in their in our higher education as educators, they were trained in this. You're not going to dissuade them from teaching sort of whatever the heck they want to teach.
That's absolutely correct. And so that's why I think we have to, if our children are old enough, we need to let them know what's going on so they can be an eye and an ear inside the classroom, inside of the school. And then also continue to look at the workshops that the school boards are putting on. they do get a lot of pressure from these teachers unions to introduce all types of things into our classroom. Unfortunately, it's not just critical race theory. There's a hypersexualization of our children. There are, you know, in my opinion, some matters when it comes to masks that are, you know, not scientifically based, that of the forcing of children to wear these masks. And like, I have my youngest daughter is a special needs child. So it's very concerning for me for her. She needs routine. She needs certain things. And I don't want her to get used to wearing a mask in that way, because that's not beneficial to her as an individual. And it doesn't help her in her behavioral progress. It actually hinders her. So what about those children? What about the children who aren't your typical kids, who are being forced into certain things that just, you know, it doesn't benefit them. And so we have to, it's a lot of work. And I know it's not something that we probably expected that we would have to do so forcefully, but we must remain vigilant. Go to these workshops, go to these school board meetings, and go to City Hall and see what is going on in your community. You will be surprised at how many things are being passed because we are not there. We are not present. We're not pushing back.
And I do want to point out that it is important that you go to the school board meetings and you make your voice known, and you basically you're putting them on notice, right? So you're putting the teachers on notice. You know, the older kids that are sitting in class, they're going to go home and talk about some of the stuff that's happening. And so you put those teachers on notice that if they go against what has now been stipulated by the governor or by the school board, you know, that their jobs might be at stake. The problem is, if they're unionized, teachers don't lose their jobs, right?
That's correct. It's very, very difficult to fire a bad teacher who is a part of the union. It's very difficult. However, we can, I think, by putting the pressure on the school board and on the teachers' unions, that will trickle into the classroom where they will realize that, okay, these parents are not having it and they're watching everything that we do. And because of their self-interest and wanting to keep their jobs, they will stand down.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Are you at all concerned that for a lot of kids, it's too late?
Part of me is, but as a believer, as a woman of faith, I have to believe that God is bigger than that. And I believe that God will, his will be accomplished in the earth. And I just believe that whatever there's nothing too hard for God. So I don't want to say anyone is beyond redemption, so to speak. I'm sort of an optimistic person.
I guess the question, I'm not asking if it's too late for individuals, mm-hmm. Because the truth is the truth. And hopefully eventually, you know, as an individual, you will get to the truth, right? Mm-hmm. Is it too late for the school?
I really do believe we can push back on this. I think they have gotten away with getting this under our noses, putting it in because we haven't been vigilant. And now that we are, they have woken up, you know, that mama bear inside of us. And I really, truly believe pushing back will get them to stand down. Now, I don't think it's going to be easy, but I certainly think if enough of us do it, there is strength in numbers. There is power in unity. If we come together and push back, I believe we really can turn this around.
I like your optimism, Keisha. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. Do you have any websites or any advice for parents across the U.S. who maybe aren't living in the greatest state under the greatest governor in the union?
Yes, we do have the greatest governor. Sure. Check out momsforliberty.org and you can see how to plug in, get involved, get some resources and tools that will help you. Also, there is Mom Rise. That is a great organization too. It's by Moms for America. And there are great tools and resources there. They're actually having an event coming soon. And also just look me up on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Keisha King with a Q, Q-U-I-S-H-A-K-N-G. Just follow me there and you can find all my links and things there.
And it was funny when you were talking, it just occurred to me, you know, we can encourage individuals to go to the school board meetings, but the reason that we encourage them to sort of form groups, and if you don't have a Moms for Liberty in your community, you can form one. or you can recruit some moms together and then talk about it. And maybe one of them will form the group and, right. and chair it or co-chair it. Mm-hmm. And so we just want to encourage people to get engaged. Go to the school board meeting alone the first time. If you're just sitting there, you just sit there and watch mm-hmm. and listen, but do get engaged and actually take a group the first time, because it's almost too late. I mean, seriously, time is a wasting. The hour is near. And we need to do something for these kids, because we can't afford for children to be taught lies in a school paradigm that, as the parent, we have now put our imprimatur on, right? We mm-hmm. are saying to our children, these are the people that need to teach you. These are the people who know. So go and learn from them. And then at the same time, we're seeing that they are engaged in teaching children lies.
You are absolutely correct. And I just want to say that know the law. Know the law in your community, in your county, in your city. Because when you go up there and you can recite the laws to them, they know that you are a well-informed parent and they cannot get anything over on you. And then that will trigger other parents to listen to you and also push back on them with the law as well.
Yeah. And you can find a lot of resources at Moms for Liberty. So go check that out and join the movement, which is a movement for liberty that's really just going like wildfire across the United States. I know you guys are getting a lot of applications for new groups for establishing new groups. And it's difficult because you have to weed out the chaff. You got to make sure that you're dealing with the authentic freedom loving individual. And that's hard to do to keep the integrity of your movement. But thank you, Keisha Great. King, so much for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Every Mojo 5.0 show is available on demand at mojo50.com.
And welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I just want to talk about the unintended consequences of the shutdown for a few minutes, and then a couple of other stories that just caught my eye. But this story out of the Wall Street Journal really got me. It's called Unintentional Injuries and the Lockdown. And the subheading is, it may take years to accurately measure deaths from COVID and deaths from the reaction to COVID. So this is Betsy McKay reporting in the Wall Street Journal. Life expectancy in the U.S. fell by 1.5 years in 2020. That's our life expectancy. We did the shutdown in order to preserve life. Is this not a redistribution of lifespan? Maybe that, like we're lengthening some people's lives, perhaps, with the shutdown, but shortening everyone else's. Okay. I'm just questioning. The biggest decline in life expectancy since at least World War II. And of course, the COVID pandemic killed hundreds of thousands and exacerbated crises in drug overdoses, in homicides, and in some chronic diseases. So this is provisional data that's released by the CDC. So I'm not making this up. It came from the CDC. COVID apparently was the third leading cause of death after heart disease and cancer last year. But get this, the virus was the leading contributor to the decline in life expectancy, according to the government. The virus was. In trying to track all the non-COVID deaths, there are a number of unresolved issues. According to Ms. McKay, the full toll of the pandemic, we don't know yet. And that's according to doctors and public health officials. Many people skipped or delayed treatment last year for conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and also the endured isolation, stress, and interruptions in normal diet and exercise routines. And that has led to intermediate and longer term effects that we will have to deal with for years to come, according to Lloyd Jones, who's the chair of the Department of Preventative Medicine at Northwestern University, their School of Medicine. He's also the president of the American Heart Association. So more deaths from homicide, diabetes, and chronic liver disease, which is related to heavy alcohol use, also contributed to last year's life expectancy drop. That's also according to the CDC. So I'm just struggling with some of this data. It seems to me that we are only considering certain sides of every issue. We're only looking at certain parts of our data. In fact, we don't even have complete data. So we're making decisions based on partial data. So there's a fire in the kitchen. And that's all the data we have. There's a fire in the kitchen. That's all the data we have. So our first response is, quick, get everybody out of the house. Instead of saying, let me grab the fire extinguisher and see if there's some way that I can put it out. Oh, look, it's just in the toaster. Too late. We got everybody out of the house. And meantime, the fire not only engulfed the kitchen, but the whole house burned down. Is that an incorrect analogy? Is that just so far off base? So listen to this, because this is the part of this article that I just sort of flipped out. Well, first of all, it says this: pandemic lockdowns, recession, and a backlash against police tactics contributed to a sharp rise in homicides in large U.S. cities that has continued in 2021. That's according to police and researchers and mayors and community leaders. There's a rise in homicide, but we're supposedly saving people from COVID on the flip side. Supposedly. Now here's where I start to question. Initially, it was 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Why? And forgive me for being logical here, but this is what I do. What is the curve that we were trying to flatten? Well, the almighty curve, the scary, scary curve that we were trying to flatten was this bell-shaped curve of infection, that there were going to be so many infections that up here somewhere at the top of the curve, we would overwhelm the medical community. We would just overwhelm them. There would be so many sick people, there'd be no place to put them in the hospitals. There'd be no medical people to treat them because the medical people would be so infected with this. I mean, initially we were told 2.2 million people would die. Okay. So that was the curve that we were trying to flatten. And then we went from that to, let's just lock everybody down so that there's no spread of disease. But that's not the way disease works. You can't lock everybody down and then hope that the disease just dies off. It's still around. The only way, and by the way, I'm having Dr. Peter McCullough back on the show in a little bit. The only way you stop the disease is developing immunity to it. Otherwise, it's still a disease. The way to develop the immunity is twofold. There are two ways. One, naturally, through exposure. And two, semi-naturally, through exposure to an inert version of the disease via the vaccine. A vaccine. Okay. Well, we got the vaccine. So in theory, the disease should be gone. No more disease. Because we will have reached herd immunity. And herd immunity is that the majority of the population is already immune, and therefore the disease is no longer being transmitted and infecting people. It might be being transmitted, but people aren't getting the infection because they have this immunity that they've developed in one of two ways. But now we have a problem. First of all, there were a lot of people who got the disease who didn't even know they were sick. That's a problem, because if the disease doesn't make you sick, then is it a disease? How are we defining the word disease? It's like, I'm tall. Should we define that as a disease now? Because there are so many people who aren't tall. I'm sorry, but I don't know how to make it's nonsensical. And then we have, yes, there were people who got the disease and got terribly, terribly ill. So let's treat them. And then are they not now immune? Or is this the kind of disease that just breaks all the rules? It's a whole new type of disease, perhaps because it was created by man in a lab in Wuhan. I don't know. All right, so here's the part of the article. Life expectancy would have fallen even more, according to the CDC, if not for decreases in mortality due to cancer, chronic lower respiratory diseases such as bronchitis, emphysema, and asthma, and other factors. I have to read that again. I have to read that again to you folks. Life expectancy, according to the CDC, would have fallen even more if not for the decreases in the mortality due to cancer. So cancer stopped killing. Cancer went on a holiday. Have you ever seen that movie, Death Takes a Holiday? It's an older movie. It was remade as a Brad Pitt film called, I think it was called Meet Mr. Black. But the original movie, very meaningful to me because I saw it when I was very young and it scared the crap out of me. The original movie, Death Takes a Holiday, death in the form of a human being comes to the earth, falls in love with a young woman and decides to basically hang out with her because he likes her. And then people just stop dying all over the world. And eventually the grandfather catches on and goes, hey, people aren't dying and you're here and you came out of nowhere. And how did that happen? And they're on an island. They're on an island. So they can't figure out where he came from. I think it makes sense. It made sense. I was very young, but it totally made sense. Anyway, death takes a holiday. So apparently a cancer death took a holiday and lower respiratory disease death, like bronchitis death and emphysema death and asthma death also went on holiday. And other factors, apparently there were other diseases that went on holiday during COVID, which I'm sorry, that's crazy. That's crazy because COVID would be a contributing factor to an asthmatic dying, but apparently it wasn't the asthma that killed them, except maybe they wouldn't have died without the asthma and the COVID on top of it. But then so the article continues, there are so many questions here, such as how cancer mortality could have declined in a year when so many were skipping cancer treatments and cancer screenings. How could cancer decline? Now, I'm not one of these people, but if I were one of those people and I read that, I would go, yeah, that's why I'm not going to seek treatment for my cancer. I mean, it puts the medical community kind of to shame, kind of a lot to shame. And where does the CDC get off with this? They're the ones reporting this. So the article questions, were some deaths that otherwise might have been ascribed to cancer or bronchitis categorized as COVID fatalities? So the article is just asking that maybe somebody who actually died of cancer and didn't even have COVID was their death might have been attributed to COVID. What would be the incentive to mischaracterize, miscategorize, misreport somebody's death? Could it be that insurance companies paid hospitals more for reporting COVID deaths? For every COVID death, they got a bonus? And then if that's the case, I hate this is a thread. I really like, I don't want to pull this, right? But if they wrongly categorized some deaths as COVID deaths, and they're being remunerated for that, what is the interest for the powers that be? And I believe it was like Medicare, Medicaid, which is government run medical insurance. What is their incentive for compensating for over reporting on COVID deaths? Are they incentivized to up the numbers of COVID deaths? Well, one incentive might be they look like a-holes with egg all over their face if COVID turns out to not be as dangerous as they originally told us it was. And if it turns out that they locked us down for really no good reason, and I'm not saying that they did, I'm just saying that would be an incentive for them to have overcompensated, to have compensated people to report wrongfully cause of death. Then we have to look at the COVID figures and understand that, wow, some of those COVID figures are actually, should actually only be attributed to cancer, maybe, or to asthma, maybe alone. And that's problematic because now we can't, because trust the data, trust the science. We can't trust the data and we can't trust the science because there is no science that's being applied. And then it says this. Drug overdose deaths rose nearly 30% last year. Drug overdose deaths rose nearly 30% last year. Suicides also rose, especially teenage suicide. So we protected children from a disease that barely affects them. The numbers for teenage COVID cases, COVID fatalities, I should say, are so very low. We protected them from that, but we pushed them off the edge. I'm just saying. Okay, I have to change gears quickly. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. And if you're listening on radio, podcast, I'll be right back. Elsewhere, thank you so much for tuning in on YouTube and Rumble. And by the way, some of my pieces will only go up on Rumble, although I'm told that I'm being shadow banned on Rumble. I've had several people. And if you want to, you know, do the experiment for me and report back, you can always email me at samsorbo.com. But I've had several people tell me that they watched the entire video on Rumble and the clicker did not move and they refreshed the page. So I don't know. There's Rumble. I'm looking into some other platforms. I heard Odyssey, but also sorbos.locals.com is probably a good place to go because everything's going up there. Some of it behind a paywall. So thank you so much for watching. And for you radio folks, I'll be right back. This is the Sam Sorbo Show.
A mojo for every state. Mojo 5-0.
And welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. Welcome back, I should say. I'm joined now by another guest. Amber Northen is a senior vice president for research at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. She supervises the Institute's studies and research staff, but she's also published in areas of educational accountability, principal leadership, teacher quality, academic standards, among others. And we're here to talk about some academic standards because Fordham just released a significant new report called The State of State Standards for Civics and U.S. History in 2021. So it's quite up to date. Amber, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, thank you for being here, but also thank you for doing this because we need to have a way of holding people accountable. We can't hold them accountable if we have no idea how effective they are being at their jobs, right?
Right. That's exactly it.
And so what are the state civics and U.S. history standards? Let's start there.
Yeah. So we have five states or jurisdictions across the country that received an A, and we can talk obviously about what that means in a minute. And so the vast majority, 20 states, had D's or F's in one or both subjects. And then you had the critical mass in the middle with a bunch of mediocre C's. So there is a lot of room for improvement in terms of what states require their kids to know in U.S. history and civics.
Okay, so it's only looking at the standards that the state imposes for each of their sort of departments of education, right?
Right. We're not looking at curriculum. Some people get those a little bit confused, but the curriculum are what the teachers do on a day-to-day basis. We're looking at what state policymakers and state boards of education are requiring their kids to know and be able to do.
And so you said that there were several that passed the test. Where were they? Let's talk about that.
We have Tennessee, Alabama, California, the District of Columbia, and Massachusetts are the five. And I've been telling folks those are both red and blue states. So this is not a red or a blue thing. If folks want to write accurate and factual standards in these two subjects, it can be done if people have that goal in mind.
And so give me an example of what a standard might be and how somebody could either achieve it or fail to achieve it.
Sure. So, I mean, basically the standard has to be detailed. So in other words, it can't be a global thing like, you know, study the role of government in creating and enforcing policies. Like that just means nothing, right? Because it's just not specific at all. But if you have a standard that says, you know, study the role of slavery in the cause of the Civil War and how it, you know, led to infighting across our country, or you actually name a cause, you actually name a war, then that's where we're headed in the right direction. So we want to see standards actually name people, places, or events and not be abstract or mushy.
Okay, so that's great. So now I have an idea of what the standards are. How do you, so just because the state has those standards doesn't mean that the schools are actually living up to the standards, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, this is the problem with mushy standards, that you just don't give districts any chance of being able to select a curriculum that would build upon those standards and strengthen them. And so, you know, it's a roadmap, it's guidance, it's not, you know, overly prescriptive. It's just saying, you know what, here's what we're going to lay out, this broad, you know, book of what we think kids should know and be able to do. And then you fill in all the chapters, you fill in all the details. But if you've got a crummy roadmap, it's really hard to then adopt a curriculum that then builds upon that roadmap if the roadmap is taking you nowhere.
So in fact, if a state had crummy standards and got an F grade from the Fordham Institute, it's possible that the schools are still teaching really great. Like the school could actually be teaching a great thing because the school would then obviously not be adhering to the standards. Or if the standard was broad enough and the school said, no, we're going to do better than that, then that's perfectly adequate, or, you know, it might be perfectly adequate, but that's not the typical, right?
Right. I mean, at least, you know, we think they have a much better chance of getting it right if the standards are clear and detailed than if the standards are vague and amorphous. But you're absolutely right. If you've got a great superintendent who values, you know, content knowledge and critical thinking skills and all these things, and teachers have great professional development and training, they can certainly take crummy standards, you know, and make lemonade out of lemons. But that's certainly not what we want the status quo to be. We'd much rather go ahead and give them something strong and high quality to begin with. And then take it from there.
Right. I mean, at that point, the question is, why is the state less interested in the proficiency of the student for civics and U.S. history, right?
Right.
And exactly. So let's talk about that. What is the importance of students understanding U.S. civics and U.S. history?
So, I mean, I like to give people this factoid. So we actually do have a national test. And it takes place every 4 years. And we test kids on what they know in U.S. history and civics. The last time we did it was in 2018. We had 15% of eighth graders who were proficient in U.S. history.
Okay, define proficient.
Proficient means, you know, you met the lowest bar for passing the test.
And what? How low is that bar?
So this would be things like, you know, name the three branches of government and know what they do. So this is not exceedingly, you know.
Right, but there's a metric, right? What is the metric that defines proficient? Because my understanding, at least in, I believe it was the state of Ohio, proficient was getting 38% of the questions correct on the exam.
Right. So on the national test, this is a national test. So the NAEP, a national organization, they actually set the bar for proficiency. So it's actually been studied, and the proficiency bar on NAEP is fairly rigorous. It's not as low as some of these other states that you're alluding to. That said, 15% is still low, obviously. And then in civics, it's not much better news. In 2018, we had barely a quarter of eighth graders who were proficient in civics. And where does this all add up? I mean, then let's look at what the adults know. And this has often been the topic of, you know, late night comedy, but it's not so only half of adults, I think it's 48%, not even half, can name all three branches of government. And basically 60% know the year in which we obtained our independence. So for 40% of Americans, 1776 doesn't ring a bell.
Not even the Liberty Bell. Oh, did I just say that? That's very sad. And in fact, it's part of why one of my talking points for self-teaching or as I now refer to home education is this idea that the government should not be involved in our teaching. It should not be involved in education at all, because there's a distinct conflict of interest with the government supposed to be teaching students that the power resides with the populace and not in the government. And the government is not teaching students that. The government is teaching students that government has the answer.
Right. And then, and if we know our Constitution, right, we know that it gives the role of education to the states. And honestly, again, it's really up to the local school districts to take the standards and make them work for kids. And so if you as a state, you completely abdicate your responsibility in laying out guidelines, it just becomes even harder for the local districts to get it right. And we're not saying, again, that these things have to be super detailed, like this is what teachers teach on fourth period, you know, on January 18th or whatnot. We're just saying, you know, give them the parameters to be able to take them and run with them.
And give them the tests so they know what they're teaching to. I'm kidding.
Kids are taught, you know, the Civil War, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, both World Wars. I mean, if you hit the nuts and bolts, they're going to do fine on that test.
Right, for sure. The other thing that you're bringing up, so I just had on a gal who is part of Moms for Liberty, and they have an organization where they're encouraging moms to go and talk to the school boards and go to the school board meetings and insist on the proper curriculum and get CRT out of our schools. For instance, that's a big one. We also have the 1619 project, also the LGBTQ plus agenda, and all of that. And, you know, to your point, the school board can make determinations that exceed state standards.
That's right. They can.
But do they?
Right. And this is why, you know, not to plug my report, but it's 5 or 6 pages that lays out what every state is requiring kids to know. And if your state got a D or an F, you know, you can look at it and say, okay, this is our state doesn't mention the founding fathers, for instance. Our state doesn't mention that kids need to know what the Bill of Rights say or the 14th Amendment. I mean, it's that specific. So if your state is not doing those things, it means that probably your local district is not doing that much better of a job, unless, like we said, you've got a really, you know, fine superintendent or great training for teachers, and they're able to learn this stuff on their own and adopt high quality curriculum. But the fact of the matter is that the civics, especially, most states don't even require a semester of civics or one full year of U.S. history. I mean, it's absurd.
And some that's pathetic.
A graduation requirement.
Yeah, that's pathetic. Really, just and so disappointing. And what are these people doing? And I want to know, like, when was the, because it was on there. It used to be, right? We know for sure the standards used to hold, hey, you got to teach U.S. history because we're American, and you should teach civics because we need an engaged population. And then one day somebody came over and said, hey, I think we should just take those things off the state standards. And everybody else said, yeah, that's fine. Looks good to me. Why would we want them on there? There's something wrong. There's something wrong with that.
Right. And what happens too is that, you know, I mean, I'm a former high school teacher. So what gets tested does get taught, like it or not. And so if these things no longer have, you know, an end of course test or a state standardized test, and I get that some people are very unhappy with testing kids, but if you don't do that, you just have no measure. You know, just we all get our annual physical, you know, once a year. We've got to know where kids are. And so, you know, in some cases, reading and math, don't get me wrong, reading and math are critical. But in some cases, what happened is we doubled down on taking, you know, double the amount of reading and math. And then, you know, history and civics sort of got, you know, well.
Hold on. I'm not going to let you do that, Amber. You know darn well they didn't double reading and math. They injected other things that have taken the place of civics and American history. And now they're going to go back to American history with the 1619 project, which is non-history. It's anti-history. And, you know, there's an agenda afoot. Not that everybody subscribes to that agenda, but there is a driving force. And that's the force that ages ago said, hey, why are we insisting that we teach American history and civics? Let's just take that off of our state standards. And those people are long gone, probably, but there needs to be some accountability. And parents need to get involved, and they need to take this all the way up to their departments of education, their state departments of education. So tell me this, where can people go? First of all, I would like to see parents go into a board meeting and quiz your board members on their knowledge of U.S. history, and then say, I require that any teacher who teaches U.S. history should take the you called it the NAEP, the National Academic, whatever. They should take the test first. Mm-hmm. In a closed system, so they can't just go look up all the answers. Once they take that test, and if they display, let's say, because their teaching proficiency isn't good enough, let's say they should display a 95% on the exam. to allow for some misunderstandings, or, you know, they goofed up and they put the wrong answer when they knew the right answer or whatever. But they should be able to pass the damn test.
Right. Well, I'll even give you one better. Just take the citizenship test. Online. You're not going to find the NAEP because they're not going to let adults see the answers, the questions of that test. But you can easily find different versions of the naturalization test that we give, you know, legal immigrants before they become legal. And that one, many adults can't pass that one either.
Why wouldn't they disclose the test to adults? What's that about?
Just because then they'd have to cost a lot of money to develop these test questions, and they can't compromise the content of the test questions. So,
but they redo the test every 4 years, right?
No, they don't. They just churn up. They've got a test bank with all the test questions, and they pull different questions every 4 years. So they don't want to have to redevelop new questions every 4 years. Anyway, that's getting in the weeds of.
I know, but I really like that. Like, I really like the idea that parents get engaged enough to insist that their teachers display an adequate level of proficiency in order to teach their children, right? We interview plumbers. We interview babysitters. We interview people before we hire them to provide services. And we don't interview teachers. We just say, well, the schools know what they're doing. And I'm just saying, you know, here's another testament to the schools maybe don't know what they're doing. And maybe the states don't know what they're doing either. What is the best state? Do we have that according to this teaching civics and U.S. history standards?
A mix. There are eight states. Oregon, we're Alabama, California, the District of Columbia, Massachusetts, and Tennessee, right and left. And what did they do right? They actually were specific. And here's the other thing. A lot of states don't amp up the rigor until middle or high school. So elementary school, these kids are learning about, you know, the flag and patriotic symbols. That's all well and good. But kids in the kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade, they're certainly old enough to begin to get exposure to the founding fathers, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. Like, we're dumbing down what we're teaching kids in the elementary and middle grades, and often waiting until they get to high school to introduce them to real content. And that is such a missed opportunity, one in which other countries, by the way, do not do. And so we need to, again, introduce that rigor early and not think that kids aren't sort of developmentally far enough along to handle rigorous content.
Would you say that over the past several decades, we have infantilized our youth?
I mean, we don't have a lot of good, I mean, I had research. We don't have a lot of really good research on the decline of what we've expected kids to know. There's definitely some good research in reading that says that, you know, if you teach phonics and, you know, and in phonemic awareness, that kids are going to learn reading a lot quicker and a lot better. And so when we do things like, you know, whole language or discovery approaches, we definitely do dumb down how kids learn, and they can learn a lot quicker if we adopt certain approaches. So absolutely, I agree with that.
All right. That's my last question. We've run out of time. Amber Northam. Northern, sorry. Is there a website where people can go get some of this information?
Go to FordhamInstitute.org. You're going to see the report right on our homepage, and then click on your state and download your 5 or 6 page report. If your state didn't get an A or a B, go to your local school board meeting and say, why aren't we teaching X, Y, and Z? Because it's not in there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the program. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. Stay tuned for more on podcast and radio. And if you're watching on video, look for another video. Thanks for watching. I'm Sam Sorbo.
A free exchange of ideas. Mojo 5-0.
All right. Welcome back to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm now joined by a very special guest, Dr. Peter McCullough. You might have heard his name. He has a whole bunch of alphabet soup after his name. He has a lot of credentials that are now strangely under attack. He's an internist, a cardiologist, an epidemiologist. He's a professor of medicine, the president of the Cardiorenal Society of America. He also he's the editor-in-chief of the Cardiorenal Medicine. He's the editor-in-chief of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. He's the senior associate editor of the American Journal of Cardiology. He's also now the author of the McCullough Report. And we're going to talk about several things, but I decided to offer him just a platform at the beginning of the show because he is very much under attack. And so I just want to go through, you know, what is happening in medicine that you would be suffering discreditation, right? Discreditation?
It's extraordinary what's happening, Sam. Thanks for having me on the show. And I do want to give a chance to just explain my professional situation to the viewers so they can understand. So I'm a licensed physician. I see and examine patients every week. I maintain my board certifications in internal medicine and cardiology. And when COVID-19 hit, I really, in a sense, left my specialty for a year to really focus and help patients with COVID-19. I refused to let my patients get slaughtered by the virus. So I worked feverishly with experts to come up with treatment protocols to treat patients early in the outpatient phase to reduce hospitalization and death. And I was successful in publishing peer-reviewed medications. I previously was the vice chairman of internal medicine at Baylor University Medical Center. I held a position within the Heart and Vascular Institute. I was the program director in cardiovascular disease. So I had standard institutional duties that I did. I was employed by Health Texas Provider Network, which is the physician organization in the parent operating group of Baylor. Baylor Scott & White Health System is one of the largest health systems in the country. All of this was standard. I had a professor of medicine designation at Texas A&M and taught medical students, wrote their letters of recommendation, taught residents. And towards the end of January, officials from Health Texas Provider Network met with me, and they told me that I was not going to have my contract renewed. And I asked the question, why? Is there any reason? Because a reason should have been stated. And the answer is no, there's no reason. We have the right not to renew your contract. And I felt that I was concerned that this was an act of reprisal for all my work on early treatment of COVID-19. At that time, like many doctors, I thought the vaccine program was safe. We didn't have any safety data. It was the end of January. My patients were getting vaccinated, and I had no opinion on the vaccine. And what happened from that time, I had a 60-day window. I changed all my patient care contracts over to HeartPlace, which is a large distributed practice in North Texas. I changed offices within the same complex. And then I had a separation or settlement agreement that basically agreed to some terms of how we'd go forward. So I was careful to honor that agreement. And I've never gone on the media with you or any other show and claimed prior positions. I never claimed that my remarks reflected Baylor or Texas A&M in any way. Now, there are always some post-production things that may happen. Somebody grabs a legacy title, what have you, and it's just beyond my control. So what happened this week is Texas A&M sent me a letter revoking my professor of medicine status and stated that I couldn't use that in any way, meaning I also can't teach students. And then Baylor, the same day it announced vaccine mandates for the entire population, Baylor launched a lawsuit. And I had to scramble two attorneys into court within literally an hour. And they had something out to the media, Detroit Free Press, that they were suing me for falsely claiming designations that I no longer held within Baylor. So this is extraordinarily disturbing because I've worked tirelessly to be pinpoint on referencing the data, being very careful with respect to every bit of scientific information I've handled throughout the pandemic. I was on Ingram Engel last night, Laura Ingram, and she brought it up. And I said, you know, all I can do is cite the data and help guide America through the pandemic. We learned late last night that the Federation of State Medical Boards will now start to review doctors who have published or presented on COVID-19 for what they term misinformation. And if somehow misinformation is declared, then those doctors' licenses are subject to being revoked or suspended. So I'm extraordinarily fearful. My family's fearful. We're in a very, very dark time now. We can't have fair exchange of information and discuss various points of medicine and science.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I will say that the video that we did must have been about a month ago or so got taken down. YouTube took it down as medical misinformation. So if, and here's the thing, how do they prove that it's medical misinformation?
You know, they have no proof. In fact, I don't know how they can even make claims regarding attribution. I mean, I can tell you, I'm not an employee of Health Texas Provider Network. I'm no longer a professor of medicine at Texas A&M. And these other titles that I hold, they could progressively be withdrawn as well. And I'll continue to update the audience on this. But so many things are beyond our control. If somebody took your face on the internet and put some attribution to it, are you going to be subject to a lawsuit from a third party? I mean, things are really, at this point in time, oriented towards really a tremendous suppression of information or even any interchange. And the American consumer of information, I think at this point in time, is helpless. I don't know how they can get fair information regarding the biggest medical problem of our entire lifetime.
Yeah, they only get the information that the information gatekeepers will allow. I have this off the CDC website. Vaccines contain the same germs that cause disease. For example, measles vaccine contains measles virus, and Hib vaccine contains Hib bacteria, but they have either been killed or weakened to the point they don't make you sick. Some vaccines contain only a part of the disease germ. Is that accurate for the shots that they're giving people today?
It's not accurate with respect to quantity and dose. With all those other vaccines that you mentioned, the actual dose of what the patient gets and the quantity of material, whatever foreign material they get, is known. Here, because the vaccines have a genetic gene transfer platform, they actually transfer a gene into human cells, and then the human cells decide how much spike protein is going to be made. The spike protein, in a sense, does cause a lot of manifestations of disease. So you can imagine millions of people have taken the shot. They have a sore arm, they maybe feel a little side effects, and that's it, and they feel fine. And so they can't possibly understand how others could have a bad time with this. But the explanation is some people must take up a lot of this genetic material. They must make a lot of spike protein, and then the spike protein damages the tissues that it's made in, and then damages organs throughout the body. That's my best understanding. That's not misinformation. That's just my doctor's understanding of what's going on with these vaccines.
Well, and if they can strip you of your credentials, well, they can't strip you of your credentials. Well, they can actually, right? The AMA could go after you and say, okay, you're no longer a doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at risk for losing my medical license and having a progressive withdrawal of all my credentials. Credentials are granted by others. And because the rules are rapidly shifting, I'm extremely alarmed at this point in time. I think all doctors who are trying to navigate here, I mean, my email box is blowing up with inbound messages of what do we do? How do we fairly inform patients on the risks and benefits of anything or anything related to COVID?
Why don't you just toe the line and tell people the shots are great, go get the shots?
I mean, I think above all, I took a Hippocratic oath to always help patients, always put them first, always honor the fiduciary relationship between a doctor and patient. And it's not in my moral, ethical, or clinical, civil DNA to go against that. I cannot make a decision that I know in my heart is not in the patient's best interest. I can't. I went into medicine to help people.
And now we're seeing reports that the Delta variant is more virulent and is infecting actually people who have had the vaccine.
Again, this is medical information. It's not misinformation. We know from the July 24th Israeli Health Ministry report that over 80% of individuals in Israel have been vaccinated. We know they're having a small rise in cases, you know, probably 10% of their prior peak, but they're having a small rise in cases. But of those cases, we know 84% have been fully vaccinated. And we know by announcements from Israel that they exclusively use the Pfizer vaccine. So we can let yourself and your listeners make the conclusion. If 80% of the population have been vaccinated and 84% of the cases have COVID, one can draw their own conclusions.
Oh, right. So in your head, you do a Venn diagram, 80% vaccinated and they're 84% of what have COVID?
80% of all cases have COVID. 84% of all cases of COVID have been previously vaccinated.
So you don't have to do the Venn diagram. You just have to look at it and say, well, then obviously that vaccine didn't work.
That would be your conclusion.
That would be my conclusion. That particular vaccine perhaps didn't work as effectively as they were promised, because if 84% of their new COVID cases have now have had the shots, then that's 84%. So they must have gotten some sort of placebo vaccine or something. Sorry.
We have to take it on face value. They received the vaccine. We have to take it on face value that they're having a lower rise than their previous rise. So maybe on a population level, the vaccine is having effect. We'll have to see how far that rise goes. But to an individual person, they've had 5,000 cases in the last week. 80% have been previously vaccinated. 84% of that 5,000 have been previously vaccinated. So, you know, there are thousands of fully vaccinated Israelis who are getting COVID-19 that have to be asking the question, did I benefit from the vaccine? We can go over to the United Kingdom where they have over 200,000 individuals with the Delta variant who sought care in an emergency department. We know there that 48% of individuals were previously vaccinated, 48%. Now, they have a different blend of vaccines. They have, in the UK, they have Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. We know of those who died of that over 200,000, but those who died, it was a small number, 460 individuals. But of that 460, we know 65% have been previously vaccinated. So that's the medical information. That's
so, so what I just heard is, according to the data coming from the UK, people who were vaccinated did die subsequently of COVID. Is that what I just heard?
Right. They died. Now, we don't have the attribution of cause of death, but there's 460 patients who died. This is in the 19th technical briefing of the UK variant report released on July 23rd. So I'm citing the data. Table number five, 460 deaths. Those individuals, 65% have been previously vaccinated.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll delve into some more of this. If you're listening, well, if you're listening on radio and podcast, this is the end of the show. If you would like the rest of this interview, please go over to sorbos.locals.com and you can look for it there. I appreciate my guest, Dr. Peter McCullough. I'll be speaking with him on the flip side. Thanks so much for tuning in. This is the Sam Sorbo Show.